What an apropos song after the election. Turn, 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 a time for every season. It is certainly a time for every season here at Street and Curb. We have a president who served as president before, joining the ranks of Grover Cleveland, coming back. We have a lot to talk about on Street and Curb. Street and Curb is your weekly word from the street. On this show, I rely on street smarts and common sense while taking on the country's issues head on. So I am your host, or I should say I am your driver for this show, Stephen Carvelli. And we welcome everyone to the radio network of Street and Curb, which is a pretty big network, and it's growing. We're here on WWDB here in Philadelphia, WZFX in Fayetteville, WTMR in Camden, WJBR in Tampa, and WBHB in Huntsville. So we'll be adding more soon, especially at the beginning of the year. We're going to be in Northern Jersey. Remember, this network is built on grassroots level. We're not funded by George Soros, and we're not funded by any large PAC. We are starting a new trend here on radio, a Street and Curb trend. So buckle up. We are hitting the street. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, it's election talk. We'll see you then.
Paul Oster, certified FICO Pro, the nation's credit repair man and the president of Better Qualified. 20 years of helping thousands of people just like you repair their credit. We have an A rating with the Better Business Bureau, and our clients have saved thousands of dollars with lower interest rates. We're currently helping people in your area, so take the first step. We have helped our clients to have hundreds of thousands of late payments, collections, and charge-offs deleted from their credit reports. Are you tired of getting denied? Tired of higher interest rates? This is your message. You can own a home. You can get out of debt. You can afford that new car. 20 years later, you have my word. If you're ready to help yourself, I know we will help you, and I'll guarantee it. Text the message CURB to the number 40691. Again, text the message CURB to the number 40691 for your free consultation and credit analysis.
Back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, or I should say I'm your driver for the street, Stephen Carvelli. And of course, we have to talk about the election. The election supposedly ranked as one of the most important of our lifetime, an existential election. Whatever the discourse may be, we got to talk about it. My biggest issue, and kind of what I want to talk about first, is what the exit poll showed as the biggest concern of the electorate. It was the role of democracy, economy number two, and then further down on the list was abortion and immigration. Let's talk about the democracy issue. We continue democracy being a concern, or the whole electoral process being a concern of a good number of voters, has really been disconcerting in itself. Why? Because we still have the right to vote. Our veterans actually fought the wars to preserve our democracy. They fought overseas, they fought WW1, WW2, whatever war they fought, that was supposed to be preserving democracy. Yet in this election, it's a front and center concern of our electorate. As a matter of fact, in Philadelphia, I happen to see placards on polls that stated in big bold letters, defend democracy. Underneath that defend democracy was the picture of Obama and Kamala. And as far as I'm concerned, or maybe I missed something, Obama's not running in this election. So I don't know what the significance is. There has been a lot of talk that during the Biden administration, Obama was the one pulling the strings. So maybe that is the puppeteer kind of concept with it. But it's also a photo of Kamala, and it says, vote. So I don't understand actually why the the Defense of Democracy has two people on there, one who is running as an incumbent vice president, running for president, and one who's an ex-president who is not running. So again, it's kind of like, you know, the role of democracy has been questioned in this election and brought into this election because there has been a sense of demonization of your opponents. Now, both sides do this, you know, one party calling someone Hitler, the other party calling someone a fascist, going back and forth. So there is a demonization of that. But the whole aspect is that it goes back to Trump's issue about not accepting the election results from the previous election and somehow having a role in the insurrection of January 6th. It is an interesting aspect that that is now the 30% of the people who voted thought that that was the primary issue of this election. It's interesting that I never thought I would live in the day to see in the United States that the whole concept of democracy is being questioned in an election, but it was. And it is an issue that even though if you thought that was the issue, again, Donald Trump won. So if you thought Donald Trump was more of the fear and the concern for the Democratic demise, it has not been the case because he actually won the election. So look, both sides who call each other names and very serious names, Nazi, fascist, Hitler, all drawn back from historical context. And it's not really applicable to the context in which it's used now, because I don't think people understand really what a fascist is and the role that Hitler did in regards to a lot of subjugated peoples is not occurring today. So even the role and the broad demonization is such a stretch, but it is a stretch that for at least one side they thought was effective and the other side was able to minimize that effect. So it's interesting that the role of democracy playing an issue, but you got to remember this one thing here. Kamala Harris inherited the role and the mantelpiece as spokesman and candidate for the Democratic Party from Joe Biden. There was not a single vote provided to her on a primary process. There was no primary process, which is a democratic principle. So again, it's so funny that those were the placards that were in Philadelphia, which was supposedly going to be the main linchpin of her electorate, because, you know, Pennsylvania being a swing state, Philadelphia being a heavily urban area, that, you know, Kamala needed to carry the city by more than, 60 to 65%, which did not happen. So it is interesting that the democracy being an issue. So the threats to democracy, you know, always come from the outside, outside actors, cyber wars, physical wars, and it comes from the internal. And this is what the current president, is a threat to our democracy. For instance, Joe Biden is the guy who runs with executive order, and he has constantly kind of bypassed a Supreme Court ruling on student loan forgiveness and continues to do that. Now, actually, in the news this morning on CNN, it talked about one of the placeholders on the pundits on the staff talked about how Joe Biden should use executive order in the next couple months that he's still in power and use it often and use it all the time to get a lot of things through that he wouldn't be able to get through Congress, even if he tried to get it through. So again, threats to democracy come from both parties, come from both sides. I don't understand the existential threat that everyone talked about, but so be it. That was a major trend of this election. One of the other issues and the biggest elephant in the room that was really not talked about is the deficit. The deficit is probably one of the biggest issues that we're facing this country, but neither party, neither Trump nor Kamala, talked about it. Nikki Haley did talk about it, but she was voted out kind of early in the primary process. But again, it is not talked about. It is actually 7% of our GDP is the deficit. That's the amount that we are short every month. That is not the overall debt amount, which is different. The deficit is 7% of our GDP. To show an example, during the height of the pandemic, when the government was spending money to prevent the economy from completely tanking in the shutdown, it went up to 14%. But we are in a non-war situation at pretty much full employment, and we are at 7%. It is projected by the end of 2026 that it could be approaching 8.5% of our GDP. that reaches a point of the deficit, that it reaches a point of no return, which is generally assumed to be 9.5 to 10% of GDP, that we cannot recover from the debt servicing that we have to do. Now, remember, interest rates have gone up. Our debt service is taking up a big component of our income for a country. But again, the debt, and this is one thing that I've been amazed at, this whole process of the election has not been talked about. You know, both Kamala and Donald have used the debt as kind of a leverage pin, but they're not talking about it because they're not going to take money back from what they promised their constituency. So it is a real threat. It is an existential threat to this country. And our growth is really suspect and not sustainable if we continue to carry the debt. It's interesting that the financial markets will basically adjust for this threat, especially the bond market will keep raising interest rates. But, you know, to have the financial markets dictate what type of threats we have to this economy and not have this economy, it's disconcerting also. So again, we have to pay attention to the debt. It needs to be talked about. Hopefully some fiscal conservatives and some budget hawks really get a hold of Donald Trump in his next term and really talk about reining in the debt. It is our existential threat to democracy. It is our existential threat to how we sustain this country. We cannot keep going the way we're going. There's going to have to be some hard talk about Social Security and other type of entitlements. And we have to restructure how this country spends money, because you can't keep spending money we don't have, and you can't keep printing it. So again, you know, the two big takeaways that people thought about in this election, the democracy, the role of democracy in the economy. And I think the economy is tied up with the debt. But that part was not talked about. So it's interesting that there are so many talking points in this election. We have a lot of things to discuss. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some more of the talking head analysis that occurred after the election and what it means to you here on Street and Curb. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Paul Oster, certified FICO Pro, the nation's credit repairman and the president of Better Qualified. 20 years of helping thousands of people just like you repair their credit. We have an A rating with the Better Business Bureau, and our clients have saved thousands of dollars with lower interest rates. We're currently helping people in your area, so take the first step. We have helped our clients to have hundreds of thousands of late payments, collections, and charge-offs deleted from their credit reports. Are you tired of getting denied? Tired of higher interest rates? This is your message. You can own a home. You can get out of debt. You can afford that new car. 20 years later, you have my word. If you're ready to help yourself, I know we will help you, and I'll guarantee it. Text the message CURB to the number 40691. Again, text the message CURB to the number 40691 for your free consultation and credit analysis.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Street. I'm your driver today, Steve Carvelli. I hope you join us every week. But today it's election time, election talk. We'll probably be talking about this for months on end. But in this show, we want to kind of capitulate some major points and kind of bring them into focus for everybody. One of the main talking points that, of course, I love watching election coverage, and I love watching it after the election has been called, because everyone either goes through a postmortem analysis or they go through some kind of victory lap. And of course, MSNBC was in the postmortem analysis because they are on the left side of the camp, and they weren't too happy with Donald Trump winning. But some of the talking points that they made, and they said that this whole election and the whole appeal of Trump and Trump's appeal to the electorate was based on fear and anger. And these pundits kind of use fear and anger as the benchmark for Donald Trump, how he reached an electorate, how he kind of scored points with the electorate, how he wasn't positive, he was dark, foreboding. Everything was negative and negative, but somehow he appeared to fear and anger. So I just kind of want to understand the fear component of it. And maybe it goes back to the original democracy aspect that, you know, if you feared when Donald Trump comes to power that he won't give up the office, that he'll be an autocrat, he'll break down the guardrails of the Constitution and stay in power. So your general response when you have fear and, you know, if they tell you in security class or personal protection class, you have to fight or flight, you know, Donald Trump's a fighter. So what did the voters do? The voters went with the fighter. They didn't go to the person who would leave. Where does anger play in this? Well, I'm going to have to go back to something that out of primarily the Democratic playbook, but not necessarily only the Democratic playbook. It is a situation in how certain people categorize and view the electorate. And it's kind of like you don't criticize your constituencies. And there's really three examples I'm going to make up here. Mark Cuban, the billionaire owner of the Mavericks, happened to be commenting that, you know, smart women are not hanging around Donald Trump. You don't see smart women around Donald Trump. And he made a big point of it. And he had to go back on The View and kind of explain that away and walk that back. And it's interesting that you could criticize a main constituency that you're looking to sway to vote for your candidate. You don't criticize them. Another example, it happened a couple of weeks ago. Michelle Obama was campaigning for Kamala, and she did not understand why the election was so close. And she was chastising the people there that it shouldn't be this close, that if you're smart and you have common sense, that you should know not vote for Donald Trump and vote for Kamala. Again, another situation in which you're marginalizing your constituency. And the third aspect is when Joe Biden, current president, was commenting on the comedian who made the very poor response and the poor remark about Puerto Rico at a rally for Donald Trump, stated that the only people who supported Donald Trump are the garbage people that he was referring to in Puerto Rico. Well, the issue with that is Donald Trump did not make that statement. A comedian at the event did, so they were able to quickly distance themselves from that. But Joe Biden's people, to distance themselves, they created somehow an imaginary apostrophe that went in with the concept of this. In other words, that if you put the apostrophe in a certain way, it looks like a word is missing, and then it is attributed to someone else when it is, in fact, attributed to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden had to walk this back, and all the Democratic operatives had to walk this back, that, you know, not all Donald Trump supporters are garbage. And if you remember that Hillary Clinton made the same mistake back when she was running 4 years ago about demonizing and marginalizing a certain part of the electorate. And, you know, why people are angry about this, I think it goes for two ways. You can't govern people you don't like to be successful no matter what you do in life. You have to like what you're doing. And if you are in government, you have to like governing and you have to like the people that you govern, or at least have a sense that you will be fair to them. So a successful candidacy, you know, it does not really belittle the opponent, and it doesn't belittle any part of the constituency that you feel is supporting the opponent. So again, it's the same mistake being made over and over again. And I think where it goes with the anger aspect, and it's not what the Democrats think it was, the anger aspect is that people do not want to feel criticized and marginalized and ridiculed and demonized because you support one candidate or the other. It's generally an issue of civility, and civility has been noticeably missing from this election cycle, and it's something that needs to be addressed. But, you know, any successful candidacy, I'm going to borrow something from the 1979 film Being There, which I thought was really a neat film about a gardener who somehow ends up in the presidency because he's at the right spot at the right time, that you have to feel the pulse and know the purse of the electorate to be elected. The pulse, you know, whether it's anger about inflation or the direction of the country, and the purse is really about inflation. So abortion and immigration were much further down the list, not that much further, but they were in the teens as opposed to the 20s that the other stuff is. But there is one more component to that equation, knowing the pulse and feeling the pulse and knowing the purse of the electorate. You have to be one more component, and that's be prepared to purchase the electorate. Now, I know it's something we don't want to talk about it because basically purchasing the electorate is what did you promise the electorate and what it will cost you. So we have a lot to talk about on that, because we're going to talk about both sides, what was promised to the electorate, and whether we as voters are going to hold them accountable for it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back right here on the election coverage on Street and Curb.
Paul Oster, certified FICO Pro, the nation's credit repairman and the president of Better Qualified. 20 years of helping thousands of people just like you repair their credit. We have an A rating with the Better Business Bureau, and our clients have saved thousands of dollars with lower interest rates. We're currently helping people in your area, so take the first step. We have helped our clients to have hundreds of thousands of late payments, collections, and charge-offs deleted from their credit reports. Are you tired of getting denied? Tired of higher interest rates? This is your message. You can own a home. You can get out of debt. You can afford that new car. 20 years later, you have my word. If you're ready to help yourself, I know we will help you, and I'll guarantee it. Text the message CURB to the number 40691. Again, text the message CURB to the number 40691 for your free consultation and credit analysis.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I hope you enjoyed the music interlude there for Turn, Turn, Turn. It is certainly a change of seasons. It's a change from Democratic control to Republican control. A whole different type of presidency is coming down the pike, and we better get used to it, because we don't have to like it, but we have to be able to accept it. So let's go about what I talked about in the last segment, a little bit about what was promised. Now, I'll go through some of Kamala's promises. She wasn't elected, so the promises are not going to generally happen. But let's discuss them anyway, and what the cost was to do these. Number one, and something she talked about before, not sure it was on the agenda this time, is possible decriminalization of illegal migration across the border. Again, if we are concerned about immigration, decriminalization of illegal migration is not on your A list. So. What does that do? And number one, it affects wages of people, because the people who come across the border illegally generally will work for less. And when they work for less, it affects union wages. It affects quality of life and wage income of life of a lot of workers in the United States, especially on the southern states. So there was a big impact on that. There was a cost of that promise. She also spoke about handouts for first-time homebuyers, namely first-time homebuyers getting a $25,000 grant. She also talked about new business tax breaks and new business breaks. So again, a handout for a first-time homebuyer of $25,000 is strictly inflationary. You're handing out money without any goods to go along with it. It is inflationary. And it's also a question about being fair. The people who are given $25,000 versus the people who didn't get $25,000, there seems to be a discrepancy about who's given a step up the ladder and who's not given a step up the ladder. But also, whether that would create a artificial inflation of prices governed by this grant. And I think possibly it would. So we would have had more artificial price stimulation of valuations of homes, and it's inflationary. The aspect for new business tax breaks, I don't know, new business has to have income to get tax breaks. So I don't know if that was even a positive or a real type of incentive. But again, tax breaks are inflationary. She also proposed tax cuts, which are also, by definition, if you have no way of raising the capital elsewhere or changing other or charging other types of taxes, is inflationary also. So these are not going to happen, because in some sense she wasn't elected, but there are some corollaries that go over with Donald Trump. Number one, he's proposing tariffs of 20% to 30% across the board. Well, that is pretty much a national sales tax, which would be a regressive tax, and is also kind of inflationary also. Now, whether this is just in rhetorical posturing to get our trading partners to come more in line and to limit some of their imports, that may be an issue. But, tariffs generally are not good for the general business environment in the long run, because they are inherently inflationary. He also wants to do a whole aspect of deregulation. Now, deregulation generally is disinflationary. It takes some of the It creates more of an opportunity for businesses to make product and services without a lot of government entanglement. It cuts cost, and it also increases production. So again, anything that increases production is generally disinflationary, and there is general talk that we're going to have a generally disinflationary and deregulatory climate. It is also good for crypto, because crypto, Trump is a prime component of crypto. Crypto being a non-centralized aspect of store of assets, it's not really a currency yet, but it may be facilitated to have much more of a mainstream approach to crypto, so that would be good to a crypto. Again, he's also talking about tax cuts, across the board tax cuts, not only for individuals, but for corporations. Again, inflationary. However, the aspect here is that if you give someone a tax cut, they use the money to create more goods and services, which counter the effects of inflation. Yeah. Now, we don't know what aspect that's going to come out at. It may be pretty good. It may be pretty poor. It may be, couple that with the tariffs, it may be extremely inflationary. But one of the things that I think both candidates understand, that inflation is a, for lack of a better word, a kind of crippling cancer on society and the American electorate. And it hurts every time you go to the supermarket. You can't get rid of it. It debilitates. It kind of affects your way of life. And apparently it affects the way you vote. So when people understand that inflation and the economy are primary issues, it really benefits the candidate to embrace that immediately and be able to make an adjustment. Now, one of the commentators today was talking about that. If Kamala had said right from the beginning, hey, we made some mistakes in how quickly we tackled inflation. It was not temporary. It was not a post-pandemic temporary response. It was more systemic and ingrained in our system, and we have to do things differently. Who knows? Maybe the American electorate would have embraced that more. But she did not do that. Matter of fact, in one of the commentaries she was making on one of the TV shows, she said, the question was, what would you do differently than Joe Biden did? And she said, absolutely nothing. I can't think of anything. Well, you know, if you can't separate yourself from the current person you're running, you're sitting in office with and who's not well-liked, you had a 39% approval rating, then maybe you shouldn't have been running in the first place. So again, mistakes were made. There were serious mistakes, but, these were really simple propositions that probably her staff should have picked up a lot earlier and be able to pivot and maybe to adjust for it. But again, it wasn't done. And this is why she's looking on the outside of an electoral college blowout. Another aspect that I want to talk about here in this election cycle is the amount of money spent. Do you realize that in 2024, $10 billion was spent on the election cycle? Yeah, that is the election cycle for president, but for every office, every congressman, every state senator, every governor, every representative running, it was $10 billion, which was 10% more than what was spent in 2020. On the presidential race, $3 billion was paid, which actually was a little lower than what was spent on the 2020 election. To give you a kind of perspective on what $10 billion would do, $10 billion would build 3,000 homes in the 495 range, which is really upper middle class homes, would build 3,000 homes. It would also build on today's cost and efforts in the same location, the Brooklyn Bridge, for $1 billion. So you can build 10 Brooklyn bridges in Brooklyn for the same price and amount of money we spent. It is, I think, absolutely obscene for this amount of money to be spent on an election. And I think the whole process needs some readjustment. I think there should be capital expenditure limits on an election. And, I have a new proposal that money should be used for work efforts. In other words, I'm running for office and whatever office, the money I raise, a portion of it goes for name recognition. It could be limited by a percentage, let's say 30% or 40%, or a dollar limit on each election, depending on the office I'm running in. The remaining portion of the money is used for a project. It could be building a bridge. It could be building houses, rehabbing houses for affordable housing, starting a school, starting a charter school. And of course, the person running for office can take credit for the action. But again, the action is good. Now, people will say, the advertising business helps a lot of people and creates a lot of GDP. That is correct. But it also, building a house, when someone can move into the house and now work in the neighborhood and contribute to the local GDP and contribute to the local taxation is good also. So there is a cost-benefit analysis going on with that. But I think we should have a forced issue in which people who are running for office have to dedicate a portion of their money raise to go towards an action, an effort that goes towards the community that they're running in. And it all can vary. If you're running for a local office as a representative, you could be for a local, books for a school or some kind of affordable housing. If you're going for president, it would be bigger projects. But again, we waste so much money on the election cycle that it really is counterproductive. For instance, on the day of election, actually the polls were closing in my area. The day of the election, I'm still getting monumental number of emails generally from Democrats about contributing still, that there's still time to contribute so that we can counter-effect some of the voting effects. I don't know. I just don't understand. My election vote is swayed at the last minute by a text or the 17 texts I get an hour from a candidate who is spending that much money on social media, then maybe my vote is really valuable anyway. But again, I don't understand the amount of redundancy. I don't understand. They said in this election cycle, as opposed to other election cycles, people made their decision early. There was probably maybe 15%, 12 to 15% of the electorate who were independent, who were going to be swayed at the end and make a decision late in the game. So they spent this much money to sway 15% of the people. I don't know. It would have been a lot better if we had an action that corresponded to an effort for a community that had a dollar amount that would have been better for them. So again, it's kind of strange that we go through this all the time. Again, I think $10 billion on an election cycle is obscene. I think money could be used a lot better elsewhere. Matter of fact, another aspect of $10 billion, $10 billion is what Microsoft is spending on AI. $10 billion. And that is a massive expenditure for Microsoft. But just look what AI did. Just think if we put the $10 billion in AI, what things we could have done better for our society, better for our constituents, better for our voters, better for our residents. It couldn't have been so much better. So we have a lot more to talk about. We're a little running out of time today. We're going to take a quick break and we come back. We'll close up the election show here on Street and Curb, and we'll see you in a couple of minutes. Welcome back, everyone. Well, we're kind of on a short stick today. We're running out of time here in Street and Curb. We want you to join us weekly, every week at this time at this channel. We have other stations at different times. You know, we're going to have serious talk, concrete actions, and we're going to have some fun too. Actually, we're going to do a seance at a Fredericksburg, Virginia battlefield at the anniversary of the Fredericksburg battle. We have that coming up. So, you know, we have to have some fun, nothing serious all the time. But again, join us next week for Street and Curb. Again, buckle up, join the ride. We'll see you next week.